North-South Connection Podcast Network. God, welcome back to another edition of The Year That Was. My goodness, we are in the Final Four. And look, I want to lie and say this whole time we've been on the road to the Final Four, but that'd be a lie since there's really only a handful of people I know in Canada that really care about college basketball. And I get it's a big thing. I just, because it's not a thing up here at all, it's so hard to connect with it. It's just one of those things I just don't understand. What I do understand, though, is the Olympics. And I guess at the Olympics, the fourth place finisher gets what? What do we give this person? Just a handshake and a pat on the ass? Anyway, welcome to episode 33 of The Year That Was, that counts down the greatest pay-per-view years in WWE history. If you're new, the story is that I watched every single WWE, WWF pay-per-view. It took me 3 years, longer than a psychology degree. Then I ranked every single match and created a system in which the years themselves are ranked in 12 categories. Then they get points for 4-star plus matches. They lose points for 1-star or less matches. And here we are with the reveal. And if you're not new to the podcast, you've probably heard something similar to this spiel 32 times already. And just please understand, I'm trying so hard to make it sound somewhat different each time. And once again, like I tend to do every episode, because it matters, a shout out to everyone who took the time to hit me up on the Place to Be Facebook group. This is where I take all the questions and comments about the years. And that's really, truly my favorite part of the show. That's not something I just say. It really is, because it doesn't allow the show to be just mine. It becomes something we share together, right? And I really do think it's an enhancement to the show, hearing from all of you. So thank you. Also, if you've taken the time to either share these shows, or even if you just drop me a line saying you've enjoyed them, just know those are the fuel that keeps projects like this going, right? Like, my God, there's a billion wrestling podcasts and we're all just doing it because we're passionate about it and we think it might be interesting, right? No one's doing this to get rich unless you're fucking the mortgage man over there, who I don't resent at all, really. I think, man, we'd all jump to be in his position kind of right at this point, right? But no, that's what keeps it going. And like a few weeks ago, I needed to miss a week. And, you know, that usually wouldn't bug me. But there's been such a great outpouring of support for this project. I really felt an obligation to get back on track. And I don't view that obligation as a bad thing. I just think it's a cool sense of community. Like, I had people reach out. Like, I just got kind of buried in work and, you know, and not wanting to half-ass it. And then I had people reaching out and saying, hey, are you okay? And you know, I was okay. There was nothing really wrong. I was just a bit burnt out. But, you know, that's just really cool. It's a great sense of community. And I thank everyone who has been even the smallest part of it, because it all matters. So I would never be so cavalier to say that this project has been free of bias. I mean, everything in this project is based on my subjective rankings. And if you've listened to it so far, you know that some of my rankings on these things are strange or different, or I tend to look at matches in terms of experience and not just the work rate, right? So obviously, the project's going to be aligned with my likes and dislikes. And I really believe, too, that anybody who says otherwise with a star rating system, even Meltzer or, you know, all the big star rating guys, like, come on, they'd admit themselves that this is their biases, right? That they have their own biases. And if they don't admit that, if they think they're truly being objective, well, they're fooling themselves. Because you can't really be objective when looking at a piece of art, which is what I kind of view wrestling as, which might sound strange to some people. That long preface being said, I don't know if there's another year more affected than my bias than this one, the fourth best year of all time, 1992. Now, I would say that from SummerSlam 91 till SummerSlam 1992, that's probably my single favorite time period in wrestling history. And even then, there's some stuff that would follow in this year, after this year's SummerSlam 92, that really helps build the year into something interesting and special. And maybe it's like the last year before I turned 13. And then that's when I kind of started feeling the pressure to hide how much of a wrestling fan I really was. Maybe it's because this was the first year that we got pay-per-views in Canada, or at least Quebec. So I finally got to watch some of these shows live instead of just hearing about the results on Superstars and waiting for the tape. Or maybe the year is really great. Maybe it is. It's the last vestiges of the Hulkamania era that enchanted us as kids. It's also a tremendous move forward this year as we transition to the Bret Harts and Shawn Michaels of the world. And the changeover in 92 is so much quicker than you'd think. By mid-year, WrestleMania, think about WrestleMania, right? Like, by mid-year, the company loses Roddy Piper, Jake Roberts, Sergeant Slaughter, Sid Justice, and Hulk Hogan. I mean, think about what WrestleMania looks like without those names. Then by the end of 92, you lose the Warrior and ostensibly Ric Flair. I know he's gone in early 93, but still, that's a massive exodus. That's seven Hall of Fame level talents gone, some of which are generational talents. And while some might lament that 1992 ends up being a failure as a transition year because of what happens after it, I think the fault of that lies at 1993's sumo-like feat. Because 92, I think, does a really good job of setting up things for the future. I wrote some through lines down, but I think my buddy Justin Pratt nails it with what he said. So that's going to be my through line, right? So, and if you like Justin, which I do, Justin Pratt and Tim Slomka, killing it every other Wednesday on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. Their show is New Gen on a Mission. So if you like the New Generation era, they are going from Shawn and Bret 1992, which we'll talk about tonight, all the way to Shawn and Bret 1997, which we still haven't talked about, which should be a bit of a spoiler. But look, these guys are killing it. I haven't listened to their last show. I just haven't had time yet, but I can't recommend their WrestleMania 9 program enough. I think they really do a good job of kind of deconstructing WrestleMania 9 as the worst WrestleMania of all time. I don't think that's true, and I think they make some really great points. Yes, Justin likes Bret Hart too much, but, you know, we all have faults, right? Like, as I'm ranking 1992 the fourth best year of all time. So New Gen on a Mission every other Wednesday. If you like the New Gen, check it out. If you like Men on a Mission, check it out. But these guys deserve your ears. So Justin writes in, he goes, 1992 feels like an earlier version of 96, where you couldn't tell which direction the company was going yet. It was half pregnant, and you didn't really know if they were going to go with the new generation or stick with the old guard. That being said, the results are incredible. Sid looking like the 1990s version of Hulk Hogan type babyface, Bret and Shawn becoming full-time singles, and the great use of vets like Savage and Flair. This year is almost as good as you, man. Oh, Justin, I love you. And that's why I bust your balls about Bret Hart. So, the first year we rank everything in are matches, match quality, and 1992 finishes 14th out of 36. Not bad. Better than half. The average match rating for the year is 2.925. So veering on 3 stars, which is kind of rare for the era. So of the years that we've done in the Hulkamania era, you know, the years in general are graded like, so for instance, 1985, the average star rating is 2.31, 86, 2.33, 88, 2.75, 1990, 2.72, and only 89 comes close, right? Now, I know this seems like we're down into the tenths of points, right? But that's kind of, when you're averaging out a system of 5, the difference between 2.3 and 2.9 is huge, right? It really, that's why 1985 finished like 30th. And 1992 is finishing 4th, right? In 1992, there's also only 30 matches on pay-per-view. And while the lowest hanging sardine leaden fruit scored 0.75 stars, everything else is at least 2 stars. And that's crazy for a year in which Nikolai Volkov smiles his way through the fall of the Soviet Union. Of all the matches I've watched for this project, too, just a little over, which is just a little over 3,000 matches. My God, 3,000 matches, that really seems like a lot. And it's crazy that there's eras that I can remember like crystal clear and then eras where, whoa, that happened? Anyway, of the 3,000 matches I watched, only 1.4% clock in for me at 5 stars. So it's usually about 42 matches total. So 5-star matches are the 1%ers that are railed at by the dissenting members of society today, right? In 1992, 6.6% of the matches clock in at 5 stars. Now, I'm no mathematician. That's why I went into the arts to never have to do math or science or French. But that seems like 5 times the average. So if 1% is usually the 1.4% is usually the number of 5-star matches, 6.6 feels like 5 times. Again, I'm terrible at math. But and yet with this year, only 47% of the matches in the overall year were good to great, with 53% being boring or bad. Another interesting little tidbit is that like years like 2015 and 2016, which are really heavily carried by their work rate, have 17% of their matches fall in the great category, meaning 4 stars or above. 1992, 16% of the matches are great. So what that kind of tells me about the year is that what is great is really strong, right? And it's supported with a bit more of a middling undercard. Part of the problem is the tag division. And if that tag division had been close to the heights of 1989, I think we're really talking about an even higher finish for this year. To give you some context, there are 8 tag team matches on this pay-per-view. 18 tag team matches on pay-per-view this year between actual long-term teams, and only 2 of them crack 3 stars. And meanwhile, Randy Savage and Bret Hart are the top babyfaces of the promotion, and with them being on top and wrestling long matches, everything's going to get elevated. And you got a guy called Ric Flair in there too. So before we get to the good, let's get to the bad. The worst match of the year. The Bushwhackers versus the Beverly Brothers from the 1992 Royal Rumble. 3/4 of a star. And I can't believe it, but I'm going to watch this bullshit. So the first thing to note, and the first disappointment of many in this match, is that the Beverlys aren't even using their awesome... They're not even using that. It's just some other... I miss it. I was hoping to hear that music at least to get me in a good mood. The genius is their manager and is going to start with a poem. He talks about defiling Jameson. What is going on with that? And as someone who's seen only got superstars at the time, I had no fucking idea who this nerd was, right? Like, why does he have a sock coming out of his jacket? The dude looks like he hasn't washed his hair in 6 months. And as I write that note, Bobby chimes in and says he hasn't washed his hair in 6 years. So we're going to get it. Look, when I was watching this, I ended up listening to it a lot more. Bobby then hits Jameson with, who dresses him? The state? Which got a great laugh out of me. I don't understand why Jameson can't dress himself. He's just a mess. And the Bushwhackers intro into this match is nearing on Undertaker length, right? And instead of just starting the match like wrestlers in a wrestling competition, the Bushwhackers march around and yell at the crowd. Bobby then states that Jameson's parents never got a divorce because no one wanted custody of him. Bobby's fucking awesome in this. He is all over Jameson for this whole match. And it puts Gorilla in a conundrum because right away he's like, I'm going to have you taken out of here. But then Bobby's like, okay, well, I'll go talk to Ric Flair. So Gorilla doesn't want to send him. It's a weird dynamic. Like, why does Gorilla care if Bobby wants to go understand? He just wants to torture Bobby. Anyway, all this, they keep talking. The match still hasn't started. The Bushwhackers are making a big production of licking each other's heads. And then they put their hats back on and march around some more. I don't know what's happening. I just want to watch a wrestling show. When I saw this was the worst match, I considered like just faking it. But no, I'm going to watch it. Butch tries to get a sissy chant going on. Albany's having none of it. Gorilla then is like, has the bell rung yet? And I'm like, I'm praying. I'm like, God, please. Because I looked at how long it was, you know, to plan my evening, right? And it's 15 minutes. And like, we've been dancing around the ring now for like, at least 5 or 6, and I don't want to do that and then 15 minutes. So I think the bell is rung. And then Heenan then claims that if you fight the Bushwhackers, you have to get everything fumigated. And Gorilla has so much indignation. You do not! Just so angry. Luke bites Blake's ass to start. They march around some more. The crowd is loving it, though, so who am I to say it's wrong? Gorilla then says the genius can only hurt Jameson with words. Last I checked, Genius was still a professional wrestler who was much larger than Jameson. For some reason, Blake then comes into the ring and kneels, and then Butch like stomps around and yells instead of attacking him. I just don't understand why they're not fighting each other. Why aren't we fighting? Then they play cat and mouse where the Beverlys try to sneak up on them. Then it's like red light, green light. Like, what am I watching? Like, we have a guy on the show who's about to talk about banging some guy's wife before he got to have sex with her on the wedding night. And here we are playing red light, green light with the fucking New Zealanders and the possibly homosexual brothers. Like, it's not making any sense. They barely touched each other in 10 minutes, but Gorilla and Bobby are awesome. Gorilla starts tearing into Bobby and saying he's upset. He goes, Bobby, you're upset because you can't manage the Bushwhackers. And Bobby says, I'd manage them into an electric chair. I swear, if you're just listening to this, it feels like an all-time classic. Also, all the pockets in Butch's pants are out. Like, they're just all out. It's driving me insane. Bobby goes, look at that. Talking about Jameson. Look at that. Look at that pig. It's just all over him. Jameson, his voice keeps popping in on the, I guess a mic is catching it, but he's got the same voice as the proprietors of Ray and Irwin's garage from It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And God damn it, I wish that truck driver would come and kick the shit out of Jameson. That would make my day. Jonathan Winters was not dead in 1992, and I'm sure he could take whoever this guy is playing Jameson. Then Bobby, out of nowhere, notes that there's a sign in the audience that says that you got to be fair to Flair. And they go into a discussion about why you're saying that. Well, I'm just pointing out the sign. Ugh. Genius beats up Jameson, and he goes, he hit it me. He hit it me hard. I'm about to get angry, but then Bobby says he didn't hit him hard enough. He's still breathing. It's just, this match is just so slow. Luke is the face in peril. Feels like an insane choice, but it has to be one of them. Luke then saves Butch to prolong the match. And then one of the Beverlys is on the top rope, and Butch walks up and grabs Blake by the penis. Did they do that to everybody? I bet they didn't do that to the British Bulldogs, because there would have been a fucking war backstage. Anyway, Beverly's win of the double axe handle. Like, all this, like, I guess they're just killing time. Can we just put something else on the card? All this, put an intermission, and it'll be fine. All this for a double axe handle. Of course, Jameson has to hit the genius. This is so fucking stupid. Top five matches on the year. Top five podcasts on North-South Connection Podcast Network. Definitely in the top five might be No Holds Barred with JT and I, where we're ranking things. We started last year. We ranked all the, what was the best pay-per-view ever in April? What was the best pay-per-view ever in May? And this year, we're tackling who's the best worker ever in May, April, May. And we just, should be dropping sometime in August, we just recorded Mr. SummerSlam. So that one will be one to watch for, because I think it's a lot of fun. That's happening, we're hitting every other Saturday on the North-South Connection Podcast Network, No Holds Barred. That runs with From Squared Circle to Silver Screen. That is Cowboy and Logan Crossland. They are watching movies with wrestlers or movies that are about wrestling, breaking them down. That's fun. On Saturdays, you also get JT's mailbag. That's once a month. JT's killing it each and every month, bringing it out, answering your questions in a completely cool and awesome conversational tone. Sundays, Second Print Comics, Mark Claire and Remzo Martinez, resident comic guys, deep dives into some really great stuff. Both guys are super knowledgeable. They have a great dynamic. Everything I've listened to from them has been very good. I'm someone who tends to stay away from things I haven't either seen or read, just in case I want to do it. I want to read it, and I don't want it spoiled. But whenever I have tuned into something, I remember them talking about Kingdom Come, and like that was one of the quintessential books that got me back into comics as a young adult. So yeah, they do a great job. That's four podcasts. I said top five. Let's also deal with Rank and File with Jordan Duncan. I think they're just finishing up the greatest television theme song of all time. That's going to drop once every month or so on North-South Connection Podcast Network. But keep in touch and let us know what you're liking, what you're not liking. Top five best matches of 1992. Number five. From the Survivor Series, Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels for the World Wrestling Federation Championship. 4 stars. I don't have any honorable mentions, but this is where the 4-star match cutoff ends. I think this is just a great wrestling match. Like, it's like they trusted these guys to just go out and deliver for like 30 minutes. And that's exactly what they did. And I believe this was like a really long match for pay-per-view on WWF at the time. And it's also rare and somewhat shocking that they let this match close out the event. And I'm glad they did, because they really gave, this is a really great solidifying defense for Bret. Because he needed those. He was a new champion. But it also allowed a great spotlight to be shown on Shawn Michaels, who I will say, until this match, not that his matches have been bad in his singles run, but I think they've been a little underwhelming considering what the expectations probably were. But these guys both came out and kind of knocked it out of the park here. Number four from WrestleMania 8, Rowdy Roddy Piper versus Bret Hart for the Intercontinental Championship. I have this at 4 stars. Two friends fight for a prize that means a ton to both of them. And we also get the morality play of Roddy Piper trying to decide if he should follow Bobby's advice and what the hell use the bell. Now, a lot of people have watched this match, right? And they think it's great. And I think it's great too. But if you want another layer to the match, so when you're watching the hard camera, There's a guy in the third row. He's almost always visible in the, he's third row. I've paused it and counted it. He's third row. He's maybe like, I don't know, three or four people from the left side of your screen, right? He's wearing a red jacket with white on the shoulders. This guy is invested. Like, he's losing it at every move. And I swear, once you see this guy, you cannot unsee it. It was pointed out by my buddy Reg, who I do Montreal to Memphis with every now and then. But once you see this guy, so red jacket with white shoulder pads, third row from the left side of the screen, about three, four people in, right? He's firmly in Camp Piper. And when Brett, his reaction is absolutely priceless, right? Like, think dude who just saw The Undertaker lose to Brock at WrestleMania 30, but like less shocked than that guy and more fucking furious as he pulls out his hair and curses the sky. Anyway, Piper Brett, great match. Amazing blade job from Bret Hart too, which he apparently passed off as legit, but it looked great. It added to the match as it always does. Number three from the SummerSlam, and I call it the SummerSlam because it's Bret Hart versus the British Bulldog for the Intercontinental Championship. I have this at 4.5 stars. And for all the smack that Bret has talked about, like I don't know why Bret does this. This is something for the Pratts and the Marcuses. By the way, if you like Marcus, viewer's choice podcast, every other, after every major WWE show, AEW show, I don't know, I haven't done TNA, NXT show. But like, check it out. Marcus and Tim bring it every single time. They break down the show. They tell you what you should go out of your way to see, what you could avoid. So if you're a watcher who's kind of in it, a bit in and out, it's a great little one-stop. And plus, these guys are funny. They make me laugh every time. And I really appreciate that in a podcast. But this would be a question for Marcus and Pratt. Why does Brett have to talk so much shit about Davey Boy here? Like, why does he have to let the world know that, like, Davey Boy, who's dead, wasn't in shape here, like, and had to carry him? I just don't understand why this is such a talking point for him. The guy's your brother-in-law, right? Anyway, I don't think you can tell that Davey Boy's not in shape by watching it. I think this match is just a really great build, and it builds to the point where you can't really imagine either guy losing in the match, and that's such great storytelling. The finish out of nowhere with the roll-up is a perfect way to end this classic. And this was one that I always assumed was a 5-star match. But to me, when I rewatched it, I must have rewatched this one maybe about 1.5 years ago, because I watched 92 a while ago as part of the project. It just didn't hold up as well. I think it's still great, but I have trouble putting it in that tippy-top tier anymore, right? And it's also not the carry job Brett would have you believe, except that botch where, like, Brett almost breaks Davey's spine jumping outside the ring and Davey's not in the right position. And it's still a great match. It's a really great match. Lennox Lewis, the guy from The Celebrity Apprentice, is there. So that's really cool. Number two from WrestleMania, Ric Flair versus the Macho Man Randy Savage for the WWF Championship. 5 stars. Easy 5 stars for me. If you want to be fair to Flair, you have to be fair and say that's a heck of a robe. Only a man as fair as Flair. And this is where Gorilla jumps in and shuts that down. But it's just such a fucking incredible match. It's such an underrated line from Bobby. And it gets lost in the awesomeness of the match. Savage comes out, jogs to the ring, and it's personal. This is, again, it's always the same thing with me. Like, if the feud is personal and the right guy is in, it's always going to score. It will always score super well for me. Like, I love it so much. Not only is Ric Flair claiming to have banged his wife, but before she was mine, before she was yours. Damaged goods! I never knew. I had to ask my dad what damaged goods was, and he did not look impressed that I had asked him that. But, like, not only is he threatening to, like, did he talk about banging her, but he's threatening to present a spread of Naked Elizabeth on the big screen. I guess they didn't want Flair to be booed. Then again, it probably had staple marks in it, so fuck him, right? But this is such a great hate-filled match. The intensity is off the charts. Savage is looking like he's just trying to murder him. And the way the match is structured is really quite smart, that Savage has control because he's such a frenzy and in such an enraged mood until he just goes that step too far and makes a mistake. He gets flipped over the top rope. He does that spot where he's literally upside down with his arms extended, flipping over the top rope. They fight back and forth. Flair gets busted open. That Flair always looked amazing with blood. Always. There's just such a great sequence. There's just so many great sequences in it. Like, there's a sequence where Flair, like, does this flip in the corner, runs to the other corner, jumps off the top rope, and Savage, I don't know if he's trying to clothesline him, but it looks like he just fucking uppercuts him like he's Ryu giving a dragon punch. Like, and Flair sells it like he's dead, and he gets, like, a 2 and, like, a 9/10 count. Like, it's just such a great moment. Then they bust up Savage's leg and just go to work on it. And it's so good. Like, he's just doing so much work. Savage is clearly so beat up. The cheating is out of fucking control. Perfect is in the ring as much as Flair. And it's funny because after the match, they'll do a promo where they're screaming about the rules being broken, which is, again, brilliant stuff. But they beat down his leg. They go to kill him. Liz comes out to stop the match. Good thing she didn't have any towels with her. And then Flair starts kind of taunting her. This is for you. Woo! And he gets Savage up with, like, his one foot in his hand, and he's, like, trying to slap him. He goes for a punch. Savage turns around, rolls him up, handful of tights, which is what angers them later, for the 3 count. And it is such a fucking huge pop. It's massive. Like, it's just this massive, amazing pop. Flair loses the belt. They beat the shit out of Randy until they finally get rid of him. Finally, and, like, I love how, like, oh yeah, Flair kisses Elizabeth. He, with all the blood on his face, he goes up and kisses her. Savage hops across the ring on one foot to fight him. The crowd's going bananas. Then when they announce Savage is the champion, it's the biggest pop of all. Like, and once again, I never heard them say once again. Once again, WWF champion. Sorry, Robert, if my Howard Finkel is bad. Macho Man. And the place goes fucking crazy. It's just such a great hate-filled brawl. It's nonstop. It's personal. And honestly, this is the culmination of Savage's career, right? If you take his career as that, we've talked about this in the past, is this trajectory from the time he enters to the time he leaves. This is the high point, probably, after he's been forced back into wrestling by, for the love of his wife, he is led right back to the top. I love this match. I don't think it gets nearly enough praise. It might be one of my favorite matches of all time. I have it ranked 16th of all time in company history. To give you some context, I have it ranked ahead of Triple H and Cactus Jack from the Rumble, right? I have it just below Steve Austin and Kurt Angle from SummerSlam 01. I love it. I might be in the minority, but fuck, it's good. And Savage looked good in gold. All right, number one match is the Royal Rumble match. Look, we're going to talk about it later, so we'll leave it there. Let's deal with the characters, which is the next category. So as characters, I have this ranked 8th out of a possible 36 years. So that's, I mean, it's pretty good. It's in the top quarter, the tail end of the top quarter, basically. And we're nearing the end of wrestlers with side hustles, which inexplicably returns in 1994, 1995. But because of this, we get some absurdities among, like, it's weird because they're transitioning, right? But you get these absurdities among some more nuanced characters and nuanced performers. So as an absurdity, Skinner is, I guess, an alligator man. At least that's what Gorilla Monsoon calls him during the 1992 Royal Rumble. Skinner, the alligator man. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say that he killed and maybe ate alligators. Did he eat them? Because it feels like it'd be wasteful not, right? Like, was he supposed to be the guy? Because I just don't get the whole image they're trying to cultivate here. Is he the guy from Preacher who, like, fucks the chickens while Jody psychologically abuses Jesse? To me, he was always less of an alligator person and more of a guy with tobacco all over his beard and upper torso. What a trooper is Owen Hart, right? For taking the tobacco all over his face and torso too. Man, how hot must Owen Hart's pants have been? What is that material? For sure it's flammable. Like, I remember as a kid, we had a tent that had this weird, I think it's the same material. And my dad said, don't light it on fire because if it lands on your skin, it'll melt into your skin. That's what I feel like those pants are. Like, if there's a house fire, Owen Hart's legs are going to be fucking blue and green and polka dot, like, for the rest of his life. Is that why Jim Neidhart quit the company? Because if those pants are sealed on the ankles and on the hips, it's like one of those guys who wears, like, the fucking garbage bags to the gym because he wants to sweat. Only Owen Hart's wearing it and throwing leg kicks. Yakazuma is fat. Poor Virgil just has zero purpose outside of Ted DiBiase. Once Ted DiBiase got the $1 million title from him. And, like, as soon as he went from the boxing shorts to, like, the striped pants, come on, it's curtains for this wrestling superstar. why? I mean, maybe I'm stupid for asking questions like this, but why does a man who has a legitimate job at some sort of repossession firm walk around like a goddamn bandit? Also, why is he wearing tires as shoulder pads? Is he just repossessing tires? Is he stealing the tires? Fuck, if you wanted shoulder pads, you can't repossess them from fucking deadbeat Hawk? You don't think that guy doesn't have debt destroying every molecule of his body? Crush was a dude who liked to crush things. And whatever it was, whatever he was trying to do, it worked. Because I loved this motherfucker as a kid. So much so that I look past the worst mullet in the history of wrestling. And imagine the sheer volume of history that that entails in terms of mullets and wrestling. I was all in on the fluorescent colors, though. I would have worn that singlet to school every day if I'd owned it. As a young child, when I got into wrestling around 87, 88, I rented a tape in which Kamala ate a live chicken on TV on an episode, I guess it was TNT, as Canadian, I have zero context. But anyway, he was going to eat a live chicken. And so it was like he walked towards it, and then they cut away, then you heard some fucking chicken screams, which now that I own chickens, I feel bad, you know. Anyways, I was fucking terrified of this guy, right? Is he eating chickens on TV? Is he eating the feathers? I had so many questions. Is he swallowing the feathers? Is he shitting the feathers? Like, feathers, you don't want feathers stick. Feathers will stick to shit. Feathers have to stick to shit. That's why we don't use chickens as toilet paper. Anyway, I was terrified of the guy because he's going to eat the chicken. Now, fast forward a few years, and I see this guy terrified of The Undertaker, and this was extremely satisfying. I don't think I've ever seen anyone more afraid of anything. This poor guy is just terrified. The Undertaker was becoming a lovable undead zombie. Yes, he's having the worst possible matches imaginable on the biggest stages, but he's over, right? And I love how at the beginning of the year, we see that The Undertaker has a line that he won't cross. So, I mean, in the past, we've seen him try to, like, suffocate a man with a coffin, tried to murder Hulk Hogan on TV. But if that dastardly Jake Roberts hits Elizabeth with a chair by accident, that is a step too far for the dead man and his fucking mannequin, weird, undead manager, Paul Bearer. Who knew he was such an advocate for abused women? He's going to spend the next 2 years fighting exclusively foreigners. He's going to go after guys from Argentina and Japan and some vague place, you know, all these vague places, right? He's building specialty coffins to get rid of all these foreigners. So he's clearly a bigot, but I think it's safe to say he's not a misogynist. And I think an underrated Undertaker moment that's, I don't know why I got lost. I love it. It's when Jake slams his hand in the casket, trapping him. He can't get his hand out of it and then starts bashing him with the chair, like just smashing him and smashing him. Fuck, that was such a cool, like, visual of, like, this unstoppable force. Plus, Jake dressing him down the whole time as he's doing it was just so, so, so good. Speaking of dressing down, we are watching TNA from the very start, and we kind of have to dress it down a bit. It's on TNA Never Dies. TNA Never Dies, airing every second Tuesday on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. Jenny Smith, JT, and myself, we started at the very first TNA weekly pay-per-view. We're now well into 2003. Yes, it's hard to get through the episodes when we watch them, but the show is so much fun to do. It's just absurd. It's just a crazy, absurd show with so much going on. That's TNA. I like to think our show is too. But let us know what you like about it, what you don't. And that runs in tandem with Jacob Williams, the Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast. Jake started at the draft in 2002. Every other week, he has a new guest come in, and they break down either a pay-per-view, Raw or SmackDown, but really diving deep into the Ruthless Aggressive, which is really kind of becoming a nostalgic era for a lot of people. And with good reason. It was 20 years ago, right? So give that a try. Jacob Williams, the Ruthlessly Aggressive Podcast. Lots of fun, only on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. So Jake was just dressing down Undertaker, but Jake was also finishing up the best run of his career. His work at the Rumble, where he watches Roddy Piper murder Ric Flair, is the stuff of legends. Those tights with the orange, yellow, red, and the flaming snakes. Like, the snakes. Snakes are scary enough, but snakes on fire? Fuck that. And I love, too, that, I mean, we only get him for the first 4 months, but it's a great arc. Because he spends the year messing with people until he fucks with the wrong guy. And the wrong guy murders him dead with a tombstone on the floor. Earthquake and Typhoon, they make a team. I think it's built on the premise that, like, it's two guys where it's physically impossible for them to have sex with each other. Ted DiBiase and IRS form a team dedicated to destroying the tag team division. Of course, they were very successful. in that. Rick Martel hates Native Americans. Tatanka hates models. I mean, it's absolutely insane that these two fought for basically the entire year and they had nothing to do with them. So they had to be like, you know what? He's going to steal his sacred headdress, right? And then he'll wear it as part of a beret. Ridiculous.
Boss man, I'm coming for you, boss man. You took years of my life, boss. Boss man!
So this guy,
boss,
starts talking and I'm immediately scared for the big boss man's life. What kind of a person sounds like that? Then he shows up and beats the living shit out of the boss man. And I remember the pictures on Superstars, all the bruises, which as a child seemed extreme, right? I hated bruises. See, when I got a bruise, my dad would push on it and then laugh. And then he'd keep pushing on them and he'd keep laughing. So much so that I have to remove myself and maybe hide. I'd wear long sleeves and pants in the summer so he wouldn't see the bruises. It's horrible. Now, I'm going to admit that when I do that to my own kids, it feels wrong. But I guess if my dad did it, it's probably, I mean, you want to replicate your parents, right? Anyway, those bruises, the boss, now as an adult, they look kind of tame. Like that crook beat the shit out of him with a nightstick and there's not 1 ounce of blood, not a broken bone. Not that I would wish this on the big boss man, but then again, he didn't exactly have the best track record with treating prisoners well after they've been captured. Like, I definitely recall a garbage man that was assaulted while his music played. And I guess the crime was wearing polka dots. Anyway, while I'm on the boss man, I think the gimmick might have been running a little long in the tooth by now. He's still the best big man who could run quickly in and out of the ring. He also threw the sweetest punches. And I guess it's logical. Like, if you're following the boss man's trajectory of who he feuded with, I guess it's logical to go from, like, American hero to American dream, to African dream, to rich dude, to tormenting a family, to fighting over with another law enforcement officer to see who really is the true form of law, order, and justice, to fighting an ex-con who the boss man no doubt mistreated while he was in prison. Shawn Michaels is too sexy for Indianapolis, but not too sexy for Sherry. I think he was a bit rough around the edges as a character in 1992. And at the time, I remember thinking, this guy's not going to be a big deal. Yep, couldn't have been more wrong about that. Coco Beware was always just screaming about high energy. Hulk Hogan was playing the most obnoxious version of Hulk Hogan. Not only is he a complete and total douche at the Royal Rumble, like what did he want Sid to do, right? They were down to the final three, like the sorest of all sore losers. And then he acts like an asshole at the press conference, like, which we're going to talk to him about more later. But like when they're going to name the challenger for Flair WrestleMania 8, his demeanor is so ridiculous. Like, yes, yes, it's me. Yes. Who on earth would say it's me? Then he gives that fucking bullshit pre-WrestleMania interview with a sit down with Vince and a tux, like they're saying goodbye. And like, he just, you know, I just won't. Is this going to be your last match? Dude, I just won't know until I get out there. Well, on behalf of the... Shut up, please. We know he's coming back. Rowdy Roddy Piper was a crazed psychopath. A crazed psychopath that had an affinity for bologna sandwiches. Also, a lover of bologna is Bret the Hitman Hart. Cool dude, wears pink. That's about it right now. His dad was a wrestler. The Ultimate Warrior died, and a whole new guy took over at WrestleMania 8. Then he started wearing those weird fucking singlets that look like a brick wall or the inside of a body like he's Slim Goodbody from the 80s. Like, at first I have to deal with the trauma of the Ultimate Warrior dying, and now I got to think about Slim Goodbody, and that's just pure nightmare fuel for any human under the age of 100. Ric Flair's a fucking god this year. Sure, great in the ring. Yeah, promos are good. But more than that, it's the chaos that he brought to each and every segment that really made it work. To me, that was always the strength of the Brainbusters or even the Horsemen in NWA, WCW. There's this chaotic element to what they brought. We saw it in 91 in the segment where Vince gets hit with the chair, but it's no less present here. The Rumble was Flair's athletic performance, but Mania was where he's at his best in a personal feud. The post-match attack I mentioned earlier is brilliant. And what I love about that post-match attack is it fuels the next like 6 months for Randy Savage. Like, he can't get over the knee injury. And then Flair goes on to create doubt in the SummerSlam main event. It's all masterful. He, Perfect, and Bobby Heenan may be my favorite pairing of guys ever. It just clicks. It worked so well that later in the year, an episode built around whether Perfect will join Randy Savage or not in a tag match is an absolute all-timer. I can't say enough good things about Ric Flair in 1992. It's a tremendous run, and his absence is felt like immediately in 1993. Randy Savage is obviously excellent this year as well. Riding high off the Jake Roberts feud, he transitions into, shockingly, another very personal feud, this time with Ric Flair. And what I love, too, is that Savage is pulled into these things because of his wife. Like I mentioned earlier, it's just a great capper to his career in the WWF. He goes from mistreating Liz to being embodied in feuds to defend her honor, right? Then he has to team with one-time enemies like the Ultimate Warrior, Mr. Perfect. Like, that's how much he hates Ric Flair. I also like the slight twinge of heeldom in the feud with the Warrior. I'm the WWF champion and you're not. Said from anyone else would have been a pure heel line, but Savage was so perfectly able to toe the line. Razor Ramon jumped on the scene and immediately told me not to care about school. I was on board. Obviously, I left the best character for last. Sid fucking Justice. I mean, you heard the music off the top of this show. Good Lord, he felt like he was going to murder everyone you cared about. He's, as a face, he's right on the edge of heeldom. He's brutalizing guys in the Rumble. That pitch of Sergeant Slaughter out of the ring is amazing. I know it's mostly Slaughter, but it looks great. Then he has the showdown for Cheers with Hogan, which he clearly wins. Then the press conference. Oh my God, what a tremendous piece of business this is. So it's a press conference to announce who's going to fight Ric Flair at WrestleMania. And Jack Tunney's chosen. And Jack Tunney starts to announce who's going to do it. He goes, the man facing Ric Flair for the WWF title at WrestleMania will be... Now, in this pause, Sid is so fucking proud. He's got this giant smile. He starts to stand up. And it should be him. He was the last man standing. Anyway, as Sid rises, Tunney goes, Hulk Hogan! And Sid is furious. Like, I don't know if I've ever seen anybody angrier on a wrestling program. I mean furious. He crumples. He's got a paper in front of him that he crumples, just rips it up. No one else had any paper in front of them. So it's not like it was like a copy of like the minutes for what's going on. Only Sid had the paper. So this always led me to believe that this was like what was written on that paper was his acceptance speech, like for being given the title match at WrestleMania. So he's got to rip that up. Then he gives one of the greatest interviews I have ever seen in front of a pile of reporters. Now, we all remember him screaming that what you did, Jack Tunney, was bogus and the most bogus act you ever pulled off. Look, this was all said through clenched teeth, which only heightened it. But the underrated part is his first shut up to the scrum of reporters. It's like a Sid, shut up. But like, I don't know if the reporters were ready for it. I like to believe that they were real reporters, like from newspapers, because their reaction is amazing. Like, it's incredible. They do a wide shot, and as he yells, shut up, the whole scrum around him moves back 6 inches. Like, in fear. They don't turn around. They all just jump back in unison. It's so good. It's so good. Next, we get the masterful false apology. Again, through clenched teeth and a fake smile. If anybody took my actions as I sincerely apologize. I apologize. Like, all this to get a tag team match with Hulk Hogan on Saturday Night's main event, where he'll be his partner. Then Saturday Night's main event comes, and Hogan starts interrupting him and ranting. So Sid just walks out of their promo, which is a great moment. Then he just betrays Hulk and threatens to kill Brutus Beefcake. Then we get the barbershop. He grabs Brutus by the hair and says, I'm going to rearrange your face. Brutus had a face surgery, so we're all scared. He smashes and permanently shuts down the barbershop. But in doing so, he goes to hit he does like a sideways hit with the chair, and he hits a can of shaving cream, which explodes up, and you see the can fly. Watch it slow. It barely misses his head, which might have killed him or at least blinded him. But then you get this all-time great image of Sid with fucking shaving cream. Like, it's not clumps. It looks like it's been sprayed. Like, if it was red, it would look like his face was covered in blood, like not shaving cream, right? He's screaming with the shaving cream all over his face. Look, it's The Undertaker reacting. The guy reacting, The Undertaker lost. It's Vince rising up with the blood from WrestleMania 19. It's Roman Reigns in the aisle at WrestleMania 33 as he's leaving. And maybe this as the best shots in company history. Then the string of jobbers. He breaks Virgil's face. And it all culminates with a promise to end Hulk Hogan's career. The promo with Gene Okerlund is so good at WrestleMania 8. Listen, you fat, bald-headed little oaf. Now you, Hogan. Anyway, Sid Justice from January to April 92 is just my favorite of all time. Another one of my favorites of all time is Wrestling Warzone. JT and Chad going through the Monday Night Wars era. They are in the summer of 96, killing it each and every time. The last one I listened to, I'm probably a couple behind now, but it was Road Wild 96. And how they both just didn't give a fuck about Dean Malenko. No, the match wasn't that great. But JT and Chad are great. You know they're great. That's why, probably why you're on the network. Every second Thursday on the North-South Connection Podcast Network, Wrestling Warzone, there for you. And that runs in tandem with ECW Three-Way Dance. Going to come back with John D'Amato and Jenny Smith and JT breaking through ECW. Always going on at the North-South Connection Podcast Network. Next category, WrestleMania. I have an 8th out of 36. It's pretty fitting that the 1992 edition of WrestleMania finished 8th, right? And it wasn't on purpose. So again, for context, and this was ranked on No Holds Barred as 8th. This isn't just mine. Some of these I did with JT. Some of them I didn't because where we were at in the project last year. But to give you some context, this was the first WrestleMania I was able to watch live as it happened. So obviously, it's going to have a very special place in my heart. It's also the last WrestleMania I'd watch live until 1997. Quite a drop-off in quality. So the opening match between Shawn Michaels and Tito Santana is immediately enhanced by the presence of Tito's sister, Ariba McIntyre. The match is fine, decent opener, but holy shit, Marty Jannetty was right there. Marty, who, as I was looking, because I want to see why he wasn't there. His real name is Frederick, which, Frederick Jannetty? No, thank you. Frederick Martin Jannetty. Anyway, what the fuck, man? Like, I get it. Like, you probably want to fire a guy who assaults a police officer, right? It's probably a good move. Yes, at this point, they still had at least one murderer on the roster, hooting, hollering his legacy away. Look, there's always at least, there. Everybody's at least like one phone call from bringing back a woman who pimped out all of her contemporaries. I'm really only scratching the surface here, but I get. Why with Jannetty did we have to take a stand? I don't see why we couldn't fire him after he jobs to Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 8. You know, work that into the storyline that Shawn really sent him packing. It only would have enhanced everything. As it stands, the match with Tito and Shawn is fine, but it's kind of a reminder of what we missed out with the breakup with the Rockers, because it takes a year to get it, right? Then Jake Roberts gets murdered by The Undertaker in a 3-star affair. This is where I should highlight how excellent Bobby was on this night. I mean, he gets a lot of credit for his performance at the Rumble, but he's just as good at WrestleMania 8. Anytime Flair's on the card, he's just as good. It's just you get an hour of Flair at the Rumble, right? He's celebrating the repeated DDTs that Jake is giving The Undertaker. He's singing da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Oh, super eclipsed by his fear when Jake Roberts like notices that The Undertaker is kicked out. And I love his line at the end because like Undertaker tombstones Jake on the floor. And he goes, I told you someone's going to get hurt and it's Jake the Snake Roberts. It was said with such urgency. What a great way to write someone out of the promotion. I mentioned the excellent Intercontinental match earlier. Then Ray Combs presented Just a Survey. It's Just a Survey. Jacques Rougeau is a provincial treasure, and Ray Combs would denied entrance to any Belle Province restaurant if he hadn't killed himself. And I was going to make some sort of wisecrack about, you know, the suicide, you know, dark sense of humor. It is what it is. But then I read how it happened on Wikipedia. Good Lord. Fuck, that sucks. I always dug Ray Combs. I also liked Family Feud a lot more when it was a game show rather than a hidden camera experience to humiliate Steve Harvey. Savage and Flair tear the house down next. I think the most underrated WWF title match of all time at WrestleMania, barring perhaps one other one. Now, if the show ends here, it's an all-timer, but it's only the second half. The second half's a bit rough, right? Tatanka and Rick Martel fight for what feels like an hour. I looked, it's 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Natural Disasters and Money Inc. continue to haunt the tag division. Of course, the big blow-off is the heels walking out instead of defending the titles. And I didn't even mention, earlier in the night, the LOD come out for an interview. And they announced the return of Paul Ellering. And I was excited because even at 12, I knew Ellering, and I was hoping this would lead to like the return of LOD as like a team of killers. You know, they're going to get back, they're going to win the tag titles. It had to be leading there, right? The tag titles can't revolve around the Natural Disasters all year, can they? It can't be leading to these two going back to old stomping grounds and discovering that by chance, your old friend Rocco's rotting husk is still among the wreckage. You mean to tell me that some homeless guy didn't pick that thing up and try to sell it? Some kid doesn't see it and in a fit of sheer terror smash it to pieces? No, instead of Ellering, who once attempted to murder Dusty Rhodes, Ellering picks up this fucking loathsome cunt and proceeds to turn the greatest tag team that ever lived into a ventriloquist act. Owen Hart fights Skinner for a minute. Then the main event. Hulk Hogan versus Sid Justice. A lot of people hate this match. They're talking about how bad it is. And I've always been like, I don't think it's bad. And I watched it for this. I gave it three and a quarter stars. I liked it. Right? I've always been high on it. Right? So I said, fuck it. I'll watch it now. I'm going to watch it now. Just see, maybe I was wrong. You know, maybe it's too much. I'm going to watch it. Try to be objective about it. Right? I mean, it can't just be me. It can't just be my delusional love for Sid, can it? So this thing starts, the Hoosier Dome. We get Sid's entrance. I don't know why Finkel is so upset with saying Harvey Whippleman's name. Like, because Harvey Whippleman's going by doctor. And really, like Finkel goes introducing, now at this time, like, and he goes, Harvey, as though it's not his real name. But he says it as though he should be saying the word doctor. Anyway, Harvey's like, this is the main event at WrestleMania. Yeah. And I am your announcer. And right there, he's cut off by Sid's music. It's so loud. Sid comes out looking like the biggest killer on earth. He's walking in beat to his music. The music is like deadly. You heard it. It's deadly. It's scary. They're filming him from the ground, and he's talking, and he's gonna send Hogan to meet his maker. I feel like this is a legitimate threat to kill Hulk Hogan. Like, it all just feels right. Right. I'm all in. I'm just on this entrance. I'm all in. They float Psycho Sid as a moniker. Hogan comes out. He's all aw shucks, brother, on his entrance. But then I kind of joke that he's coming back, but he might be leaving because he looks moved by the crowd cheering for him here. Like, that's how you would act if it was the last time. So Hogan gets to the ring and Sid attacks, and they keep playing the Hogan music, which they've never done before. And it's amazing. Sid starts beating on him, and in a great classic Sid moves, he grabs the bandana off the ground. He goes to the ropes and whip it onto the floor, but he misses, and he only whips it to the apron. But the velocity with which he threw it, it's so hard, and it goes nowhere. It's a perfect Sid moment. Anyway, Hogan fights him out. He flies out. So, and then I don't know if this was planned, but so he knocks Sid out of the ring. And then he pulls Sid kind of back up and kind of turns him around and ties his arms in the ring. But just as he does this, it's the guitar solo of Real American. And he's got him. He's holding him by the neck. The guitar solo's like going crazy. Hogan's doing the cups to the ear before nailing him. The timing on this is absolutely perfect. Like, it's as though they choreographed it. Then he rips his shirt to the last chorus of the song. All this to say, he has whipped the crowd into a frenzy. Like, it's just a frenzy. I think the beginning of this match to this point is incredible, and it's probably the best start to a Hogan match ever. Music is playing. It's super well-timed. Crowd going nuts. Sid's chin is out of control. Sid starts clubbing Hogan off the start of the match. He's screaming at the audience, shut up! Now, the match is slow. Sid's taking time in between moves, but he is filling the time. He's playing to the crowd. Sid wants to test his strength. The crowd is going nuts. Hogan loses the test. And even when he tries to kind of power out by rallying the crowd, Sid just keeps overpowering him. And this is exactly what should be happening. Sid's dominating, but then Sid clubs Hogan. Hogan reverses an Irish whip, hits him with a running clothesline. And Sid's kind of shook, right? He's not down, but he's shook. Harvey then jumps up into the apron, distracts Hogan. And then Hogan turns around and Sid hits Hogan with a sweet one-handed choke slam. Now, the way the camera cuts, I would imagine it didn't get him that far off the ground, but it still looked amazing. Like, it just looked so good. Sid was always great at the one-handed choke slams. I think his best one's on Virgil, but... And Hogan selling the choke slam, quivering. The heat is crazy. Sid then walks over to the camera and goes, do unto the man as he would do unto you, but do it first. And my dad knew this quote. He was like, he finished it before Sid did. I was so impressed that he knew it right into the camera. And Hogan has had zero offense since the start of this. Sid kicks and pounds. Hogan's out of the ring. Sid beats him up with a doctor's bag on the outside. I can't believe Kevin Dunn didn't cut to Sid Because at one point, Sid goes to another camera, but you don't see that camera. You see Sid's back, and he goes, I'm loving every second of this. Like, how did he miss that? Okay, and then they get in the ring, and there's an application of a nerve hold, which I get is not a good look for this match. And I hate the nerve hold, but the crowd is screaming the whole time. And when Hogan raises the arm, like, for the third drop, like, for the submission, the place explodes. Hogan fights out. Sid suplexes him. Sid calls for the powerbomb. He fucking kills him. The powerbomb looks good. He goes to the ground with it. You could tell it was safe, but it still looked good. Great sell by Hogan. Hulk up. You know, he works his way to a body slam. The first time Sid is knocked down the whole match. Hits the leg drop. Kick out. Who cares if Papa Shango missed his cue? Who cares? I'd rather Sid kick out of the leg drop. And then we get the DQ. I'd rather Sid just powerbomb him and pin him. That would have made this match 5 stars, right? If Sid and Hogan had done John Cena and Brock Lesnar from 2014 SummerSlam, this is a 5-star match. But look, as it is, who cares if Papa Shango missed? He comes down. They beat the shit out of him. The Warrior comes back with music. The crowd is losing their minds. It's just an all-time moment. Fuck it. This match is fun. Look, there's a nerve hold for 90 seconds. It's the only part that isn't filled with action. I being as unbiased as I can, I know I love Sid, so there's obviously some bias, but I don't see a lot of flaws in Sid's stuff here. He was so into his character that he filled all the time. The crowd was in a frenzy for nearly all of it. So maybe the worst main event so far in WrestleMania, although I'd probably have this match ahead of the main event of WrestleMania 4. But I don't see the reason to hate it or say it's not good. Give me a counter argument that goes beyond, it sucks. James Grunberg. 1992, the most missed opportunity that WWE missed. Doesn't take anything away from the Macho Man versus Flair, but you had a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Ric Flair versus Hulk Hogan in their prime, WrestleMania 8. Does Aaron think they got the right opponent for Flair? Well, it wasn't once. They could have done Hogan and Flair at WrestleMania 19. So I don't know if it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Then again, you did say their prime, so I'm in the wrong. So the big question with this is, why not Hogan and Flair? So it's such a hard thing, right? Because I agree the decision is stupid not to have Hogan and Flair, but I wouldn't change Savage Flair for anything. So I guess if you do Hogan Flair, I guess the card looks like this. So you still have Sean Tito. You have Undertaker versus Sid, right? Because that's kind of where they line up, if not, because other things. You have Bret Hart versus Piper. That doesn't change. Ray Combs versus adult onset diabetes. Then I think to close out the first half, you do Savage versus Jake in a cage or something is the big blow off. You do Tatanka versus Dignity, the tag title shit show, Owen and Skinner, and then you end with Hogan and Flair. I don't know if that's a better show, though. Because we've seen what Taker and Sid looks like at WrestleMania. And even then, they might have put Sid over Undertaker here, and then we'd lose the streak. So I think ultimately I'm happy with the show we got, even though I would have made the decision to put Hogan Flair. I would not have made the decision to put Savage and Flair, but I'm glad they did. So I think the way to fix WrestleMania 8, not that it needs a lot of fixing, but is to tinker with the undercard, right? So do Sean versus Marty, like bring him back to job him, right? And if you can't do Marty, do Sean versus Owen. Owen is just a better opponent for Sean at this point, I think. You want Tito on the card? Blow off Tito and Martel. Leave Tatanka off the card. Or put Tatanka in the 10-man. Keep Taker versus Jake. Keep Bret versus Piper. Do the LOD winning the belts back for Money Inc. Hogan, Sid, and maybe finish with Flair Savage. Or even if you want to do something different with Sid, instead of Undertaker and keep... you're still going to have... you could just do Jake. Put Jake somewhere else. It doesn't really matter. But put Jake and Tatanka. Who knows, right? Whatever. But if you wanted to do something different with Sid, have Sid have a mystery opponent or have Jake. Yeah, that there we go. Have Jake have a mystery opponent or Sid, and it's the Ultimate Warrior. He's there anyway. So, and it pays off the Warrior Jake stuff from the year before. Anyways, I love 8 as it is. It's one of my favorite shows of all time. I wouldn't change it, even despite its flaws. Nikolai Tarp. Mania, Flair over Hogan. SummerSlam, Flair over Warrior. Survivor Series, Savage over Flair. Mania 9, Bret over Savage. Would never happen in a million Vince years, but what a year that could have been. Just goes to show the potential in 92 with so many other cool possibilities. What we did get was awesomely fun, though. What a great year. Thanks for the show, Aaron. It's been a really fun ride. Keep up the great work. Thanks, Nikolai. That sounds like a really cool plan. Flair over Hogan, but Flair's not going over Hogan. That it's more of that. Like, not that they're not going to match them up. I wish they did Flair Warrior. We'll talk about that later. And Brett over Savage has always been on my radar. But yeah, definitely. Like, that it is cool with 92 because it could have gone so many different ways, right? Next category, world title storyline. I have this third out of 36 because look at the world title. It's vacant at the start, which is rare, and they didn't use the word abeyance, so it's already good on my bit, right? But it's interesting because it's up for grabs in the Rumble, and then Ric Flair wins it. And then it gets thrown into a very personal feud with Savage and Flair, and then Savage, as the champion, is forced to face his greatest opponent, the guy who retired him. And then you get the mind games of Flair and Perfect, and then we transition back to Flair, who's transitioning to the new Standard Bearer, who ushers in a completely new style and company philosophy. That sounds like a great year to me. Plus, you get the end of Hulk Hogan, the debut of Ramon. That's what the top of the card looks like. I love it. I'm good. Rocco, Mark Tone, my man Rocco. So Rocco chimes in and he says, in 1992, I was in the 10th grade and had just discovered partying, going to shows, and most distractingly, girls. My first love, pro wrestling, had to take a backseat with only occasional booty calls in the shape of pre-sports Saturday morning wrestling and the occasional magazine purchase. Even without my absolute devotion, the idea of Flair in the WWF, especially as the champ, was mind-boggling. Yeah, right? Even more perplexing was that he wasn't fighting Hulk Hogan. Yeah. It was a dream match in my mind for years, but in retrospect, wasn't the Macho Man the best choice for Flair? They were perfect dancing partners. The arrogant cocksmith against the man who we had just witnessed complete his journey of redemption. Savage learned humility, respect, and had just married the woman of all of our dreams. Now this interloper is here to ruin it? Yeah, I agree. It's a better storyline, right? You could always, yeah, it's a better storyline, I think. Back to Rocco. How do you think Flair would have fared in a feud with Hulk? Would it have been anything besides invading champ of Federation we don't even ever acknowledge versus our WWF champ? No, that's what it would have been. It would have been the real world champion. That's what they were setting up, right, in 91. Flair's the real world champion. Hogan is the WWF champion, right? And then Rocco says, I feel like it would have played out just like the invasion did 10 years later. Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. Then Rocco asks, was Savage the only top guy to ever exist like a human? Thank you for using human. He had a family, friends, and basic emotions. What's the most human display Cena or Hulk ever had? Did Steve Austin exist outside the arena and in vehicles? Did babyface Roman had a wife, kids, or a humanizing, debilitating disease? We will never know, but we did with Randy. Yeah. Yeah, no, Hogan was not a human. He never acted like a human. He was an asshole. He was an asshole. Like, if you did the same thing he did to you, he'd get angry, right? Every single time. So, no, he did not. Cena, no. Cena didn't have emotions. Cena had frowny face and happy face. That was Cena. I think the closest we had is Austin, because we can agree with him being pissed off. I think it's humanizing to hate your boss. Right, I think that's actually a true thing. I think maybe closest after that is Punk, but he's not really a tippy-top guy, right? But just the idea of us being frustrated at the whole process. But yeah, no. Yeah, Savage is the best tippy-top guy at ever being a human, hands down. All right, back to Rocco. I really wish I could have watched Sid in his prime because goddamn that dude was charismatic. Maybe this is a question for 92 in the Royal Rumble, but is Repo Man getting two eliminations the best outing for a jobber in the Rumble ever? How? Who are you to doubt the Repo Man, Rocco, and call him a jobber? He has tires for shoulder pads, and he has a job. But yes, you're probably correct. Maybe Sam Houston. Sam Houston really hangs into that 88 one. Danny Davis. Danny Davis in 88 hangs in a lot, too. Aaron, with the Flair Rumble performance as a highlight of 92, besides this incredible podcast series, what is an impressive instance of something involving impressive stamina that you have accomplished or been a part of? Insert sex. Fucking! No. Also, what is a goal or project you've planned in the future that will require some serious dedication on your part? Love you. Love the show. Love you, Rocco, man. Thank you so much. You are such a highlight of this show for me. Hands down. So I went back to school at 39, and I just recently, in May, completed a psychology degree. That was stamina because I was working at the same time. I also built my own business in my 20s. So from, I would say, age 21 to 32, I didn't make a penny in acting, but I built my company. So I was working another job and building it. And then it was able to, you know, I was able to live off my company until COVID. We'll see what happens. But So those are the kind of things. Goal or project I plan for the future from stamina and dedication. Well, I have to next go for a master's degree because I am working towards taking on counseling patients. I need a master's degree for that, which is easier said than done. But we'll see what happens. That's my plan in the future. Thank you, Rocco. You're the man. Mid-card storyline, next category, 11th out of 36. So the Intercontinental title is still presented as one of the most important prizes in the company, which is one of the main reasons why this year finishes as high as it does. Brett enters the year as Intercontinental champion, but unfortunately is patient zero for the coronavirus and has to drop the strap to the Mountie at a house show. Imagine the pure courage of this man wrestling in a 110-degree temperature. Then the Mountie was murdered by Roddy Piper and were given a super hot match at WrestleMania. And I should probably stress how cool a moment Piper winning the Intercontinental title was at the time. I mean, Hot Rod had never held a championship in the WWF, and this one, along with a tag team run with fucking old age Ric Flair and him, are the only championships he ever had. This made for a tremendous legitimizing match with Bret Hart. Not only helped Bret get to the next level, but also gave us like the roll up out of a sleeper, which has been used almost as many times as the Money in the Bank cash in at this point. Once Bret gets the belt and we find out we're going to England, we get a nice little family feud with the British Bulldog who conquers Bret. Sadly, we never found out if Davey Boy Smith wanted to or not win the match. But I guess those are the consequences of living in a pre-internet world. I don't remember a single thing about Bulldog's Intercontinental run other than him dropping the title Shawn Michaels before the Survivor Series 92. And I feel like Michaels was always the destination by year end, and the belt around his waist made sense. In retrospect, it's kind of a shame Bret didn't get to be the one to drop the title to Michaels. I think it would have added another layer to their complex relationship. There's not a ton else going on in the mid-card, but I do like that they took the time to try and build some feuds rather than just sticking guys together. So Taker's mad at Jake for crossing a line, so he tries to murder him with a coffin and a chair. Boom, feud, you know? Who's prettier, Sean and Martel? Feud. What, a prison cop abused his power? Crazy. And the guy who he beat up got released from jail? Oh man, Boss Man's gonna get it. Wait, Boss Man's a good guy? Holy shit, would Nails ever be an overface in 2021? He could have Antifa march him down to the ring and they could be screaming about defunding the big Boss Man. Crush didn't like thieves. Look, I'm stretching here. Tag team storyline. This is 1992's biggest flaw, right? So the LOD start off the year as champions. Great. All is correct in the world. Then they have to defend against the largest team in the company history. I'm still on board. It makes sense. Two killers, shoulder pads. This is the kind of people that should be able to challenge them, right? Then they drop the titles to a makeshift team at a house show in Denver for some reason. Then they go off and walk the streets of Chicago. I can only assume they're homeless at this point and that those shoulder pads make possibly the worst pillow ever conceived by a human, Rocco. Then when they finally get another shot at the team that took the titles from them, they had already lost the belts, so the only victory LOD could achieve was that of a moral nature. And they won with a power slam. And the team they lost to was Money Inc., which seems a lot cooler in theory than in practice. I mean, if you look at this through the modern lens, there's no way a millionaire would be happy to see the IRS. But in Vince's fucking mind, they're both money. Both guys represent money. They only get the tag title shot too because Jimmy Hart like takes a bribe and like takes their contract over the natural disasters, which turns the disaster's face. It's so weird that this is the storyline to keep going back to Jimmy Hart for. Like, it reminds me of the Hart Foundation in 88 when he's like, you're still under contract to me, so I can still make money off your ass. But at the same time, I'll work with a sadomasochist to fuck you over. Hi, everybody. I'm Jimmy Hart or Mickey Mouse. I just have no idea why you'd want Money Inc. as a team in your stable instead of the natural disasters if you're Jimmy Hart. Again, unless you're offering them room and board, because that's a lot of space and a lot of live chickens. Anyway, this contract controversy not only turns the disaster's face, but also the Nasty Boys. So we're supposed to cheer the Earthquake and Nasties. I mean, Earthquake killed a guy's pet last year, and the Nasties are just humongous pieces of shit. That being said, they're both more likable than Tugboat. And with all this bullshit going on, the LOD left. Or, more accurately, Hawk jobbed to alcoholism, all right? And the most interesting team left, the Beverly Brothers, just get lost in the shuffle. I mean, I've been on board with the Beverlys becoming tag champs rather than Money Inc. Both guys look cool. Their theme song was underrated. Not their first one that I had to listen to. They're good one. They could go. Sadly, they do get a shot at the titles at SummerSlam, but it's to the natural disasters, and they're just fodder. Thankfully, the head shrinkers around the corner to pick up the slack. There was the failure of the new Orient Express, and Owen Hart just couldn't keep a partner. Maybe he was the problem. Why'd everyone have to fucking wear those fucking flame pants that are going to burn into your leg? Anyway, it's a hard year to rank for tag teams, right? Because I can't put it last. On one hand, they clearly gave them a ton of focus and importance. I mean, besides all the title change happening on house shows or on random episodes of Challenge, it's a crazy stat. LOD wins the tag titles at SummerSlam 1991, and then those belts don't change hands on pay-per-view until WrestleMania 11. I know there's a tournament in there, but WrestleMania 11 is the next time that someone loses the tag belts to someone on pay-per-view. But I'll have to say the tag teams were given storylines. They were focused. They were a part of big events. But then all the matches sucked. I mean, what do you expect with Ring General Ted DiBiase involved in most of them? So how do you balance it? So it's not the absolute worst era of tag team wrestling, but it's clear that there's a before and after 1992 when it comes to tag teams in WWF. Look, make no mistake. Vince McMahon never liked the art form. And I get it. Why would you pay for two guys when you could pay for one, right? But until 1992, tag teams were always heavily featured, given storylines. But after 1992, it's not the case. And it's never really been the case again. Even now, we get great tag team matches, but they're not really in storylines. Going forward, there's going to be great teams. The Steiners come in the next year. But there'll also be a ton of makeshift teams like Well Done and Techno Team 2000 or just guys that are thrown together. So did 1992 kill tag team wrestling? Hard to say. But since Money Inc. and the Natural Disasters feuded, tag team wrestling's never been the same. So fuck it. They did it. Women's storyline, 16th out of 30. There's nothing to say here. It gets the middle grade. There's no women that fight. Sherry's great, but she's not wrestling. All right. Royal Rumble match. Look, if you like the Royal Rumble, now entering the Royal Rumble every Monday on the North South, every other Monday, excuse me, on the North South Connection Podcast Network, running in tandem with this show. We, JT and I, are breaking down every single entrant into the Royal Rumble. The last guy we did was Hulk Hogan, and we went through all, we talked about how much of a bitch he was in this match, but we go through all their performances. We rank the individual performances, and we rank the guys cumulatively. We've really tried to give good focus to every single person. Like, you'll never hear people talk longer about Butch and Butch's performances in these things, right? So now entering the Royal Rumble every other Monday on North South. So this Royal Rumble, it's first out of 34. And that's no surprise. This is the first pay-per-view that was available for me to buy in Quebec. So I begged my dad to get it. And there was a lot of finagling that had to happen because it was a weekend. My parents are divorced. And it was a weekend that I was supposed to stay with my mom. And she hated wrestling and me. So there was no way I was going to get to see wrestling live if I stayed there. I invited a bunch of friends over to watch it. And I was firmly behind Ric Flair from the start. They were not. And I don't know why, as a 12-year-old, I connected with Ric Flair. I mean, if you get older you grew up with the NWA, you get it. But I was 12 and I didn't. Maybe it was the After magazines that I was able to get my hands on. As a WWF guy, I can never understand, I mean, me angry too, why Ric Flair was constantly rated higher than Hulk Hogan every month on the overall PWI or The Wrestler rankings at the back or the middle of the book, wherever it was then. Now it's the back. Also, there was always pictures with him with blood all over his face. So how could he possibly be winning matches? But I did connect with him right away. And on this night, I was cheering him from the very beginning. My friends were getting more and more agitated with each of the Nature Boys' escapes. My dad, who was only a cursory fan, got sucked in and started watching with us. And he would laugh at Bobby Heenan, which really clued me into Bobby's greatness, right? And I found him hilarious as a kid. I still find him great now. But I think there's something about being a teenager and hearing Bobby Heenan. By the end, my friends were enraged and Flair was still there. And when he won, they lost their minds. I'll never, ever forget that night, right? To this day, if I'm trying to get someone to watch, like, new into wrestling, I'll usually go with a Royal Rumble as an entry point. My go-to is usually 1990, but I'll often use this one. And the response is always the same as the match goes on. It's always, the old guy isn't going to win, is he? This match is perfect. We've all seen it. We've all watched a bunch. I don't think I need to detail it as much as I would some of the lesser known rumbles. But I think it's perfect in large part due to the work of not only Ric Flair and the workers, but Bobby Heenan. Because the work in the match itself isn't perfect. There's a couple of lulls in the early going. But those lulls are just wonderfully sold with the urgency of Bobby's delivery. Every guy who comes out, Bobby's upset. They just keep getting bigger. And I love that, like, Bobby goes from, oh no, to later on the more foreboding, oh no, as the night goes on. Between Bobby and how they booked everyone to go after Flair immediately, they kind of unwittingly booked the perfect bounty storyline. This is exactly what 1999 should have looked like with Steve Austin, right? And you know you're onto something special when Bobby views every single person in the ring as a threat to his guy. Christ, he even gave us some backstory into the Barbarian, telling us that he was not, in fact, a hairdresser on his day off. And the match is not just flair. There's lots of great stuff. Shawn Michaels is a stud in the early segments, which we chronicled on Now Entering the Royal Rumble. Davey Boy has a great run. And everyone who enters after Piper, besides Skinner, adds to the match. And that Piper bit, oh my God, such great booking to get Flair alone in the ring and have Roddy run out. Hot Rod can barely contain his excitement, and Bobby just can't contain his fear. Oh no, he's so scared. The whole next sequence with Piper, Flair, and Jake is sublime. Jake sits there, watches Piper choke out Flair. And this, I mean, look, this whole performance by Bobby is legendary, but this whole thing is, it might be the best part. First, Jake attacks to save Flair from Piper. Thank you, Jake Roberts. But then Jake attacks Flair. You can never trust a snake. I told you could never trust a snake. Then Piper saves Flair from Jake. And Bobby begins a tirade thanking Piper. Thank you, Roddy. Thank you, Hot Rod. It's a kilt. It's not a skirt. I've always said it. It's a kilt. It's not a skirt. And then Piper turns on Flair and he's like, Piper, you no good skirt wearing freak. It's just so good. The whole thing is so good. Yes, I don't know why they put Nikolai Volkov in the match. Maybe the Mountie was too embarrassed, or was he still selling getting tased? Volkov looked like he was having the time of his life. But it's impossible for anyone in the crowd or the ring to have cared less about him. Watching him trying to engage the other wrestlers in the match is like watching the awkward guy in the club trying to alienate all the women. The end is fire. All the best guys are still in there. The drama that happens with Sid and Hogan. Ric Flair then pays off Heenan's suffering and fucking wins. Which is not only an incredible feat, but somewhat shocking based on him coming in at number 3. The match is a masterpiece. The post-match interview where Flair tells us all with a tear in his eye, it's the greatest moment of his life. Makes us forget that Gene Okerlund was screaming at Pat Patterson or whoever else was smoking backstage. What more can be said about this one that hasn't been said by people more articulate and handsome than me, right? Flair's performance coupled with Heenan's commentary makes this one of the most special matches you'll ever watch. The added stakes of having the title on the line works so well. It's the most important Royal Rumble ever. The booking's great. And like I said, we always go on about Flair and Flair, but like Piper, Jake, Undertaker, Savage, Sid, Hogan, even the fucking Boss Man all play their parts perfectly, right? The final six guys are the huge newcomer, the real world champion, and three of the most defining guys of the era, and the current longevity record holder. Fantastic ending. Fantastic show. Obviously, it's a 5-star match, and I have it as the 8th best match of all time. Also, fun fact, if you were to run all of Haku's Rumble entrances back-to-back chronologically, you'll watch a man slowly losing his battle with obesity. Let's hear from Jared Robert. Jared, 1992 does hold a personal spot in my heart because SummerSlam 92 was the first pay-per-view I saw. Thank you, Coliseum Video. Thanks, Coliseum Video. You made my childhood great, too. Looking back on the TV from the time period, though, it's undoubtedly a down period for the WWF, especially after WrestleMania 8. Thanks to WWE Network, the stretch of superstar episodes from the spring-summer of 92 can be rewatched, but I gotta say, it's one of the most bland stretches from WWF TV I have ever sat through. Mind you, I haven't regularly watched WWF products since 2001. Well, that's why. I'm sure they're fucking Oscar-caliber episodes compared to a 2017 episode of Raw. Regardless, that April to July, August 1992 stretch is admittedly a dull watching, and things don't get remotely interesting until the build for SummerSlam begins. Despite the underwhelming TV product, the WWF pay-per-views miraculously delivered and are fondly remembered today. While I still like the WWF pay-per-view offerings in 1992, I feel they may have become overrated through the years. The Royal Rumble is rightfully praised as a great match, but you have to take a look at the undercard. I understand that the Rumble match transcends much of it, but the Beverly Brothers vs. Bushwhackers was the worst match of the year written all over it. Hey, you nailed it, Jared. I agree. As a total package, I prefer the 91 Rumble over the 1992, even though its Rumble pales. 91 Rumble, the undercard, look. The 91 Rumble undercard is better than the 92 Rumble undercard. I will agree. The 91 Rumble is garbage. As someone who's watched it like 15 times now for Now Entering the Royal Rumble, it's awful. So that's a hard call. I think there's other card. Like when we did it on No Holds Barred, I think it ended up number one. I think it ended up number two. But 2018 first, which I think was fine. I was kind of acquiescing to JT there a bit because I'm of the mind that the undercard should have counted for more. But it's just an argument. Like we push. I think both of us are pretty good on that show with backing off when we either think that the in the end it doesn't matter what's ranked where, right? Like, hate to let the secret on you. I don't really care. It's just what it, you know. It's more about the destination, right? But at some point, the argument stops being entertaining, right? So we stop it. Yeah, I don't know about 91, but I agree with you. The undercard does hurt it. Okay, back to Jared. To me, WrestleMania 8 is largely a missed opportunity of what could have been. Flair versus Hogan, Savage versus Jake in a cage. Don't get me wrong, Savage versus Flair is great and Hart versus Piper is a classic, but the rest of the card is pretty underwhelming, despite being inside the cavernous Hoosier Dome. This is a stadium show that doesn't feel like a WrestleMania to me. It's kind of ironic that the previous year's WrestleMania emanated from the little LA sports arena, and yet it feels more like a Super Bowl of sports entertainment than this. Yeah, I don't agree with that, but I could see it. I also don't think it was cavernous, the Hoosier Dome. I thought the crowd was, I'd go back and listen to that crowd. You can hear them. SummerSlam 92 has a lot going for it, an epic stadium atmosphere, a heated main event, an Intercontinental Championship match that is one of my all-time favorites. Outside of those three things, though, you've got a card with a lot of matches that doesn't gel well with the programs being promoted on TV. Maybe that's a good thing, given how lousy the WWF TV product was during the stretch, but if there's one thing I don't care for on big pay-per-views, it's a match booked simply for the sake of having a match to take up space on the card. You'd hate modern wrestling. As great as SummerSlam 92 is, remember, for every Savage Warrior showdown or every Bret Bulldog battle, we also get Virgil versus Nails and Undertaker versus Kamala. Kamala. That was an accident. I rest my case. Okay, here's the problem with that case. This is the problem I ran into, and I'll explain it a bit later. But so when you're looking at that, it's hard to look at it from that angle, right? Here's why. Because Bret Bulldog is 26 minutes, right? And Warrior Savage is like 20. Entrances, that's like over an hour of the show, of a 2.5 hour show. Over an hour of it is the great stuff. Nails Virgil's 4 minutes. And yes, I understand it's long. And Kamala Undertaker is 3 minutes. So it's hard. You're right that for every one match, there's this, the other match is this. And this is an argument that I, last time I did a project ranking things, I ignored that nuance. And I think it really hurt the project, right? But it's true. Like, you know, it's hard to even off an hour of the show versus seven. Well, I guess there's entrance. Let's be fair and say entrances and everything. There was 20 minutes. So an hour of the show versus 20 minutes. Right. I also don't think it's a tremendously compelling Survivor SummerSlam. Back to Jared. As for Survivor Series, it's 1992. It's okay and at times refreshing, but the Survivor Series elimination match concept is almost completely abandoned here. Should have been abandoned with who they had in it, and hurts the show overall because it's now just another pay per view. Yes, I agree. Overall, 92 is still very good, but I must admit I'm surprised that it surpassed 1989 and 1991 in your overall rankings. I'll try to talk about why that is at the end. Okay, Jared. I've been talking to a lot of new people lately. I've been dealing with Johnny C. and Ryan Gray, you've heard a few times on this network. We recently had the Money in the Bank preview special, and we're going to have some cool stuff coming up in the next few weeks or so. So be on the lookout for that. Ryan's a cool guy that I met doing this project, and we started to build a friendship, and it's really nice. Like I said, I've been really grateful for the friendships that have kind of happened over the course of this project. And, you know, if anyone has ever got an interest in doing a show and they've never done it before and they want to try it, get in touch with me because that's how I met Ryan. I started chatting with him and he's had an idea. We had ideas and bounced them around. Also, Johnny C, you're going to hear his debut later in the week. We're trying out a new project there. Me and Johnny breaking down a different era that we've never talked about on the North-South Connection podcast network. So be on the lookout for that. I think it's dropping on Thursday this week. But yeah, I'm really grateful to be meeting these guys and I'm building these friendships. It's really cool. All right, historical importance. 17th out of 36. So it's a massive year for transformation. We already spoke about the massive exodus, but this year also stands as a great model for the company going forward with wrestlers on the top. Actual wrestlers, though, right? And I think that's a really interesting and important distinction because we're going from entertainers to wrestlers, right? Flair and Bret Hart prove that you can be a technical wrestler to Vince and be over. 1993's failure, though, is the reason why this year can't be thought as completely transformative. The pieces were all there, but I think the company got cold feet. And I think that's why I don't blame 1992 for the failings of the mid-1990s. We lost a ton of big names in 92. Like I mentioned, Hogan, Warrior, Piper, Jake. But everything was really well set up. By the end of the year, Bret was legitimate enough to be the world champion, and he was on his way to becoming someone who could carry the company. The mid-card was in good shape. The tag title scene was a bit lagging. And I think it's also a huge year in terms of the success of SummerSlam 1992 at Wembley Stadium in England. Still the only major WWE pay-per-view to be held outside of North America. I don't count those bullshit blood money shows. The company was widening its international footprint. And that may seem like a small point now, but at the time, you know, this is something that might have helped them stay alive during the difficult financial times that were ahead. All right. SummerSlam, 13th out of 34. One of the first things I ever wrote, and this was I was talking about to Jared when I was talking about those things, the rankings. One of the first things I ever wrote for any sort of wrestling site was 2015 when I wrote an article called The Scientific Ranking of SummerSlams. I basically made a giant list, still on PlaceToBeNation.com. I basically made a giant list of every SummerSlam match ever ranked from best to worst. I want to say that there was about 220 matches in all, and they're all assigned points based on position. So if there were 220 matches, first place received 220 points, second 219, all the way down to the last place match getting 1 point. So it just counted every match with the exact same value, right? They're all worth the same amount, whether they were 20 minutes or whether they were 7 minutes. And the last place match, I'm sure, was Taker versus Taker. Then I added up all the points, ranked the SummerSlams based on this really weird metric. And 1992 finished last. And this was a problem for a lot of people that read it. Not a lot, but a couple of really vocal jerks, right? And I swear, it was like I killed their dog. Like, who cares if I don't think the pay-per-view you like is the best of all time? I don't care if you don't think Hogan Sid is a good match, right? I don't care. Like, it was just a clear, flawed system. Just as the one for this project is probably flawed, right? But the outrage was ridiculous. That being said, I don't think this one holds up as being anywhere near the top of the heat. And I feel I even ranked it too high, ranking it 13th. Yeah. So it really all hinges on where you land in the WWF title match. If that doesn't crack 4 stars, the card's going to feel lackluster. The main event is great, but the rest has some of the worst matches of the year. The opener's a good match, all right? I loathe Money Inc., okay? And as a team, they constantly put me to sleep throughout the great insomnia summer of 2013. Then you add Rocco to the... Oh, I wish it was Rocco Martone in the mix instead of Rocco, the fucking wooden puppet. And then you have this match because of all this that's struggling under the weight of all the stupid shit around it. If Animal claims that this is LOD's crowning moment, I really hope he was talking about the damn motorcycles. Nails and Virgil, it's just choking for 5 minutes followed by an attempted murder. What's the point of Nails, you know? What's the point of attempted murder? Just do murder. It's also my 4th worst match of the year. I really dug Martel and Michaels going at it. Sure, it was played for comedy, but it landed. And, you know, when you get down to brass tacks, both guys could go, right? I could have lived with a longer feud from these two. Now, at the time, wasn't every match no punching in the face? Also, the post-match theatrics are a lot of fun. The crowd hated Michaels. Like, that's how effective the barbershop segment was, right? They end up cheering a guy who turned on, like, the nicest guy in the promotion, and who's also a visible minority, right? And then he tried to take a man's eyesight with cologne, and then he would, like, name a team after, ha-ha, I can see and you can't, calling them the Visionaries. And this crowd is still cheering this man over Shawn Michaels. Disasters in Beverly's is fine. No heat. The title match between Savage and Warrior is very good. I have it at 3 3/4, and I think it just missed the cutoff of the top 5 match of the year. I do think it lacks, though, because Savage, I think, is at his best when he's in a personal feud, and this is not a personal feud. But everything to do with the whose corner is Mr. Perfect in, great, right? The spots in the actual match were so well done that the crowd was biting on all of them. Like, they booed when they tripped Savage. Then they bit just as hard when Flair leveled the Warrior with the brass knuckles. It's just great. The crowd was ready to boo Randy Savage, too. They got really mad when it seemed like Perfect was on his side. I think the biggest problem with this match is the attire of both guys. Whoever dressed them should be brought before some type of council and executed. Both guys looked like lamer versions of their old selves. Warrior's wearing that skin tone color signet. It's like they saw that and like, you know what would be a good idea for a giant? Put hair on it, right? And there's a Warrior symbol on the Warrior's dressing room door that Warrior's child clearly drew with crayons. Savage must have had long forgone the trunks and with the stars in favor of the tights. But then I don't like he's wearing the matching shirt. Just looks second rate. There's just so much color. Why is there so much color? Like, I could barely hear myself over it. Crush beats the Repo Man, 6th worst match of the year. Undertaker Kamala stink up the ring, 5th worst match of the year. And look, if you can get past Diana Hart Smith talking about going to the front lines with her husband, you'll love the main event. I mean, look, nice guy Sean Mooney's cutting off Diana Hart Smith, right? You just cover your face with that frilly jacket and take the walk of shame to the dressing room. And again, Brett can say all he wants that this was also his crowning moment, but this is Davey's moment, and he'll never get higher without the aid of heavy sedatives or perhaps resurrection. To this point, easily the best SummerSlam match in history. Maybe not easily. I think I maybe have Warrior and Rude ahead of it. Definitely the best main event. Tells a great story, sends the crowd home happy. What a novel concept, right? No humiliating the hometown hero. Crazy stuff. And there's some other great things to love too, right? The sunset as the LOD ride to the ring, Sherry's slut suit. But for every good thing, there's Rocco getting a ring introduction, right? But again, I think the good outweighs the bad. Bobby and Vince do a fine job on the night too. It's not a bad job. Like, Vince is no Gorilla Monsoon when it comes to dealing with Bobby, though. For whatever reason, he just can't keep up here. And the brain, whatever the brain does, Vince is refusing to run with it, right? He's basically the worst improv partner in the world, refusing your ideas and throwing out about 50,000 English puns. Still, Heenan's funny. Vince is decent. The clicking isn't there, but it's still good. And I don't understand why Vince is always promoting pageantry. Why is that a big thing? There's going to be pageantry. Why does he love pageantry the way he should have loved his son? Anyway, the SummerSlam you thought you'd never see is good. Not great. I've watched it a bazillion times. I'll watch it again. Worst show of the year. Before I do that, let's hear from Mike Eller. I know it's only four shows, but how many years can say that every single pay-per-view is either very good or great? Not many, Mike. 1992 can definitely make that claim. The 1992 Rumble and WrestleMania 8 are shows that are very rewatchable. I don't like SummerSlam 92 as some might. Nah, me neither. But I do recognize it's a good show. It's a good show. I really love Survivor Series 92. Oh, cool. So a different view than Jared. It's awesome how different it is from Rumble 92 with Bret and Shawn main eventing. And then at the beginning, they were clearly in the mid-card. A really cool moment from the show is Mr. Perfect making his entrance, and he has this huge smile on his face. It's really awesome to see him genuinely happy getting all those cheers after years of being a heel. Yeah, that is a really cool moment. And he deserved it. And he was a good face. Just for whatever reason, they decided not to run with him, right? But yeah, you're right, Mike. I don't mind Survivor Series. But the worst show of the year is the Survivor Series. It's the one pay-per-view I didn't buy this year. I guess it was a hard sell on the way to Christmas. But it look, honestly, Mike and everybody, it finishes last, not because it's bad, but I just think the other shows are better. I could hear an argument for why the Rumble should be the worst show. But then again, it has one of the best matches of all time, so blah, blah, blah. High Energy fights the Head Shrinkers. Rare good tag team match in 92. Boss Man and Nails fight for a nightstick on a pole. A young Vince Russo must have watched this, and this was like the idea that launched 1,000 ships. Tatanka and Martel fight over a feather. Savage and Perfect make a really fun team against Flair and Ramon, who make a funner team, I guess. I could have lived without the Tease dissension or the BS finish. I mean, Savage and Perfect should have just won. But I'll live with anything in this match that gets us that primetime episode where Perfect decides to team with Savage. It's such a, that's something everybody should go back and watch. It's an hour build with a fantastic payoff. It starts subtle too. Heenan makes kind of an offhand remark, and then Heenan's like, you're supposed to do what you're told. The match itself is very good. Yokozuna sends Virgil straight to the goddamn Olive Garden. The one Survivor Series match can't even break 2.5 stars, but I've said enough about the bad stuff about the tag division. We get the first coffin match and it's boring. Like, imagine all the effort, but like building that coffin in a shop The Undertaker took for a 5-minute match. Kamala was so traumatized by the whole affair that he took up bowling and stopped eating people. Then Bret and Shawn have the great match. And yeah, it's long, but it's great and it's different and it's a new era. Best show of the year? WrestleMania, for all the reasons I broke down earlier. I do think too, we keep going back to the Rumble a bit, but you know, it could have been a much better show. If that has a better undercard, it's the best show of the year. I don't know why, like they really loaded it with tag team matches, but I don't know why they didn't double since they doubled Piper. Because in theory, you could still have the same WrestleMania 8, but you could blow off Savage and Jake here. You could do LOD Money Inc. here. Like, you know, and that could be instead of like, you basically get the Wembley match. Hell, even do round 56 of the Warlord and the British Bulldogs. Anything to get that fucking Bushwhackers match off the card. But I think there's moves they could have done to make it better. Michael Schoen. In hindsight, I can understand why 1992 ranks so high. The 1992 Rumbles match still holds up as the best of all time, in my opinion. Mine too, Michael. We finally see Hogan get eliminated from the Rumble like a little bitch. Plug the most recent new out during the Royal Rumble. Yeah, we just talked about it last week. We also see the early ascension of Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. I do think the company left money on the table by not cooking Flair versus Hogan WrestleMania. It seemed like a no-brainer. But nevertheless, I will never complain about a Savage versus Flair match. Looking forward to listening and getting to number one on the year that was. Props to your commitment on the project. Yeah, man. Thanks, Michael. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, too. I'm not looking forward to being done. Like, it feels like this is just like a part of me now. But yeah, I know it makes sense to do Hogan Flair, but I don't want to trade that match. All right. Five worst wrestlers, five best wrestlers. Then we're out of here. Five worst wrestlers of the year. Number five. Virgil. The high point of his year is not getting made fun of by Ray Combs. He was also the guy who consistently took the big beating from the next big asshole. Sid, Nails, Yoko. No one took a worse beating than Virgil in 1992. He had his nose broken, his body squished, his anus violated. And all it got him was a fifth place finish as worst wrestler of the year. Number four, Repo Man. He certainly didn't steal our hearts. Am I right? Oh, sorry, repossessed our hearts. Brutalized by both Crush and Ray Combs. This is where he belongs. Number three, the Big Boss Man. And I feel bad because I probably shouldn't give him some props and points for being in the Rumble. Usually the Rumble, my rule has always been I can give up to four people credit for the Rumble. But I really just gave it all to Flair. I don't even know if Boss Man would have made it if I had. But he was really solid in it. That uppercut to Shawn Michaels and that weird kind of kick in a circle he gives to Flair, top notch. But then he does nothing. Nothing in the 10-man. A nightstick match, while not horrible, just ranks near the bottom of the year. Number two, Kamala. Scared of The Undertaker, sticking up the ring with The Undertaker. And how can he still not fit? He's been wrestling for fucking years now. He still doesn't know how to pin somebody? Man, I hope that pimp turned Reverend straightened his ass out. And speaking of straightening asses out, the worst rest of the year is Nails, obviously. Nails blows harder than he had to in prison. It's the one time I've been in favor of police brutality. Look, if the fucking Boss Man had just killed him behind bars, we would have been spared from this run. And not only that, the world may have never seen that fucking old bag Judy Bagwell riding on a goddamn pole. Five best wrestlers of the year. Number five, Rowdy Piper. On the strength of a very good match and great moment at the Rumble, to the Rumble itself, to finally the best singles match of his career with Bret Hart at WrestleMania. I mean, it really took Ric Flair coming in to make Roddy Piper interesting and, dare I say, bearable. From his return in 89, Piper was, besides, I think, a brief interlude with Rick Rude, trapped with very little to do. Then Flair shows up and it's like he's got energy again. Just a great all-around, I want to say year, but it's 4 months from the Hot Rod. But he made us love him again. And then he took the fuck off. Number four, Shawn Michaels. Really propped up the title match. At the Survivor Series. But then his year is really solid. Really underappreciated performance at the Rumble. Maybe I'd give him points for the Rumble. Good match with Tito and a fun romp with Martel. What an emotional roller coaster for Sherry 1992 was. Fuck, she falls in love. She faints 30 times in one night, 30 times in like 15 minutes. And then in early 1993 gets blasted with a mirror and mauled by a homeless woman. Rough year. Number three, Randy Savage. And I thought it was going to be his year to win. I really did. Decent at the Rumble, an all-timer with Flair at Mania, and a very good match with the Warrior at SummerSlam, and a very good tag match to close out the year. Savage brought the emotion to the Flair feud and was a worthy champion in the absence of Hulkamania. In any other year, he probably wins it for him. But alas, he's three, because number two, Bret Hart. Happy, Marcus and Justin? I guess I shouldn't be shocked, though. Bret is the man in 92. He's still not the winner. And he misses a show. Great match with Roddy, all time with Bulldog. Great match with Michaels. Look, I don't think 1992 established Bret as a tippy top guy, but it established him as a credible main eventer. And the number one wrestler of the year, Ric Flair. I mean, how could it not be? The greatest Roman performance of all time. The match with Savage, I've already heaped a ton of praise on. And a very good match to close the year. 2 5-star matches, right? Very few guys in WWF history have 2 5-star matches in a single year. I think Flair accomplishes this, and they hold up, right? Now, in a perfect world, he wouldn't have taken Survivor Series off, and he would have fought the Ultimate Warrior there, which Nikolai brought up. But I've always maintained that that was a dream match that we didn't get, and I think it would have been really good, because if Hogan, Roode, and Savage had great matches with the Warrior, man, Nature Boy would have nailed it, right? Ryan Gray says, the greatest Rumble ever. Take that, Saudi. Yeah, we'll take a lot of things, Saudi. Don't tell me to get thrown off. Anyway, back to Ryan. It's a super fun WrestleMania. You can nitpick and move things around to make it better in retrospect. I did. I'm sorry, Ryan. It's still a strong and memorable show with Bret Piper and Savage Flair. Same wavelength with SummerSlam and WrestleMania. Two home run matches, Warrior Savage and Bulldog Bret, at the rest kind of just there. However, the SummerSlam's undercard is kind of the shits. I agree. Survivor Series is carried by Bret Shawn. Their best match, Aaron? Yes, I agree, Ryan. I think that's their best match together. I think my favorite is the 97 one, but I think this is their best match together. Back to Ryan. Flair Razor versus Perfect Savage was fun too. Good quick pivot after the Warrior flakes out. Yeah, it was good. So overall, the best way to describe 1992 would be fun and memorable, even though you can reflect back and move things around to make it seem better. Top five is definitely warranted, though. Awesome. I like to finish with some agreement. All right, so look, I get it. This might be too high for some of you, right? And I'm sure I have a clouded view of this era, but I do think the year has some really strong positives. Two of the divisions are strong. It has the greatest Rumble, a very good main event, Mania, and a very good SummerSlam. Plus, you've got Ric Flair fucking wives in the first half of the year and fucking minds in the second. I want to go back to Jared's point earlier because I think there's an argument to be made that 1992 is actually fairly close to years like 1991 and 1989. But I think it just outperforms them on the big shows and events, or at least it's a little more consistent. So, 91, when I look at the Rumble card doesn't count in this metric. I just look at the Rumble match, right? 91 is an awful Rumble with a very good Mania and a great SummerSlam. 89 is a fine Rumble with a fine Mania and a great SummerSlam. 92 is just strong across the board, right? In the end, it finished 4.5 points out of 89. So super close, right? But in the categories 92 won, it won big. And that's why it landed here. It's only 3.5 points out of third place. So the LOD keep the tag titles and we get some good matches out of them. Maybe this finishes third. But I love the year so much. Savage is great. Flair is awesome. And Sid Justice exists. This is an easy win for me. 1992 for me too is all about the last time until adulthood that I was comfortable being a wrestling fan. By high school, I felt I needed to keep this passion in the closet. In early spring of 1992, I went to a house show. It was right before Mania 8. It was March 27th. I looked it up earlier. The main event was supposed to be Savage versus Jake in a cage, but Jake wasn't there, so we got Sid versus Savage in a cage. Sid murdered him dead, by the way. IRS was on the card. It didn't even matter. I loved it, right? I bought Bret Hart sunglasses and a WWF phone title belt, which I wore to school the next day. My grade 6 teacher saw this and put them on herself and made fun of the whole thing. And this led to many kids in my class laughing at me. And like you couldn't be known. It sucks that this was the mentality. It sucks I wasn't braver, you know, because you couldn't be known as the wrestling guy if you wanted to be popular. So 1992 closed a chapter in my life where this was a social activity. I still watched it, but, you know, by myself. I think to be made fun of for something you love in many ways is heartbreaking. Like, it's the reason today why, like, I'll never make fun of a show like Paw Patrol that my kids watch because it just meant so much to them for a certain, not anymore, except for my youngest, but it just meant so much to them for a certain period of time. I'm not going to make them feel bad for having liked it, right? Because I know what that feels like to be done to me, right? You know, who knows how much more I would like the product to be invested if I just said fuck it and kept doing it. It took till 1997 to get comfortable enough to even tell people how much I liked wrestling. And I was super nervous when I wore an Austin 316 shirt to a party. In the end, I'm the idiot, right? I wish someone was around to tell me that it's cool to like whatever you like. I wish I was smart enough that when someone said, you know, it's fake, right? I could reply with, well, yeah, well, Braveheart is fake. Not Braveheart. You know, Star Trek is fake, right? You know, like, why is this favorite thing treated differently? I wish I was braver, you know? So 1992 is bittersweet for me as a fan. The highest of highs is like me watching my friends lose it at Flair winning and me cheering. Coupled with some lows of like moving away from this thing that I loved because of petty fears. I mean, it's a good thing I no longer have any pride or shame. Otherwise, these shows and the tremendous friends I've made along the way, it just wouldn't exist. Next time on The Year That Was. A year that was an incredible disappointment creatively, but produced some absolutely incredible matches and memories that still hold up amazingly well today. In 2 weeks, we give out the bronze medal. Come on, we're down to 3. You probably haven't figured it out. See you then.